After all, only one in 365 people qualifies to wear a shirt like that, and perhaps one in 1,000 of those would actually wear one. And I don't know, perhaps one in 100 of their friends would think to search for it. So the vendor probably sold 4. But there it was. More searching found shirts like the one that said, "Legendary, since April 6th, 1988. Oh, I see. It's a long-tail business. A few companies are making tens of thousands of different shirts. They're making them to order. The long tail and the infinite shelf space of Amazon makes this possible. They might not sell any, of any particular shirt, but taken together, it's reasonable to assume that they're selling thousands of shirts a month. If you can aggregate a chunk of the long tail, you can make a go of it. But you can't possibly sell just one obscure shirt and have a shot. This is the false promise of the internet, that you can be happy with a tiny slice of the long tail, that anyone can sing or write or dance or do comedy or coach or freelance, and so anyone will, and so you'll be fine. Except you won't be fine, because you can't live on that. The internet can live on that. Upwork and Fiverr and Netflix and Amazon can live on that, but you can't. We hear about the outliers, the kids who make millions of dollars a year with their YouTube channel, or the fashionista with millions of followers. But becoming an outlier isn't a strategy. It's a wish. There is a way out. The math of a hit is about more than the benefit of selling a lot of copies. Actually, hits are hits because people like hits. We like to do what everyone else is doing. Everyone means everyone like us. You've probably guessed the strategy. By dividing the market into many curves, not just one, we end up with many short heads and many long tails. There's the market for literary fiction aimed at teenagers, the market for books on chip carving, the market for video courses on using a GH5 camera to make movies, and the market for performing improv. There's even the market for drone music played so loudly that the audience needs to wear ear protection. In each of these markets, and a million others, there's a need for a short head, at least once someone has connected the people in that market to one another, so they realize that they exist, so they see each other, and so they understand what the hit is. Because it's the hit that connects them. Once they see it, they'll probably want it. This means that living on the long tail has two essential elements. One, creates the definitive, the most essential, the extraordinary contribution to the field. Two, connects the market you've designed it for and helps them see that you belong in the short head, that this hit is the glue that holds them together. Rocky Horror is in the short head. So is the DeWalt 20-volt Max XR Lithium Ion Brushless Hammer Drill. It's the hit that unites us, the one that makes it clear that you are people like us. Yes, the internet is a discovery tool, but no, you're not going to get discovered that way. Instead, you will make your impact by uniting those you seek to serve. Bridging the chasm. We have no idea who discovered the pothole or who named the Grand Canyon, but Jeff Moore discovered the chasm. It's the overlooked but often fatal gap in the Rogers curve, the curve of how ideas spread through the culture. The early adopters go first. They buy things because they're new, interesting, and a little bit risky. They do that because they like things that are new, interesting, and a little bit risky. But there's a problem. There aren't enough of these neophiliacs to go around. Big organizations, mass movements, and substantial profits often depend on the mass market. They need action from the rest of us. The mass market is where Heinz and Starbucks and JetBlue and the American Heart Association and Amazon and 100 others live. How do you get there? The intuitive answer is that the early adopters will bring your idea to the masses and you'll be done. But often, that's not what happens. It doesn't happen because the mass market wants something different from what the early adopters want. The mass market wants something that works, something safe, a pattern match, not a pattern interrupt. They take people like us do things like this very seriously. Moore's point was that few innovations glide from one part of the market to the other. That's because in order to satisfy the early adopters, you may just need to annoy the masses. The very thing your innovation did, break things, is the one thing that the mass market doesn't want to happen. They don't want to trade in their DVDs. They don't want to learn a new software platform. They don't want to read their news online. To understand how this collision feels, go spend an hour or two at the help desk at the Apple Store. Check out who's there and why. Listen to their questions and pay attention to their facial expressions. The middle of the curve isn't eagerly adopting. They're barely adapting. That's why they've chosen to be in the middle of the curve. Where's your bridge? The bridge across the chasm lies in network effects. Most of the fast-growing marketing successes of our lifetime have spread because of ideas that work better when everyone knows them. The early adopters have a huge incentive to bring your idea across the chasm to the masses. It will make their lives better if everyone in their network also uses this idea. There's no reason to talk about a new kind of chocolate you really like. Doesn't make your life better if others eat it. On the other hand, you spend a lot of time telling people about Snapchat or Instagram or Twitter, because if your friends followed you, your life would improve. That's the simple ratchet power of network effects. Connected tribes are more powerful than disconnected ones. Individuals who get in early have an incentive to bring others along, and so they do. It's not just technology, of course, although it is often the force behind the pattern interrupts that have remade our culture. There's an incentive for me to organize a bus trip to Washington, D.C. to protest gun violence. If more people come, not only will we make more of an impact, but the day will be more fun as well. There's an incentive to get your friends to sign up for the local CSA Farm Share. The farmers can't afford to come for just a few people in the neighborhood, but if lots of people come, there will be better variety for all of us. The peer-to-peer movement of ideas is how we cross the chasm, by giving people a network effect that makes the awkwardness of pitching change worth the effort. The bridge is built on two simple questions. One, what will I tell my friends? Two, why will I tell them? It is never the case that people will tell their friends because you want them to, or because you ask them to, or because you worked hard. Give them a why, and that usually involves changing what you offer. Make things better by making better things, things that have a network effect. A ratchet, a reason for sharing. Surviving the chasm. The Gartner Hype Cycle is a brilliant meta-analysis of how the culture changes. I've posted a picture of it at seth.blog/charts. The technology trigger opens the door for your art, for the contribution you want to make. It interrupts a pattern. In that moment, marketing can help you reach the neophiliacs. Inevitably, these early adopters will hype your work. Of course they will. That's one of the best reasons to be an early adopter. When the idea is presented to the rest of the market, it can't possibly compare to the hype. Hence, the trough. This is another way to see Moore's chasm. It's in this moment, when the neophiliacs are bored with you and the mass market disdains you, that you will most likely lose momentum. This is the moment when you need a bridge, a new way to step through the culture with stories that match the worldviews of this new, more conservative market. And then, with generous persistence, you can walk up the slope to the new plateau, the place where you are now indispensable to the masses, a new pattern replacing the old one. You might not find the bridge. Years ago, my team at Squidoo launched HugDug.com. The idea behind HugDug was pretty simple. You could build a page. It took about 4 minutes, profiling any product on Amazon that you loved. If you chose a book, for example, the page would bring in the cover, the title, and a big button with a link. You'd add your own review and a bunch of relevant content. If someone found the page and bought the book, Amazon would pay us a royalty, and we'd send half of it to your favorite charity. This was years before smile.amazon.com, and we were donating 20 times as much to charity as they do. Our bet was that authors would happily promote their books in this way. It was easier to control than their Amazon page, and they could have pride and ownership in how the information was presented, not to mention the philanthropy of it all. We also hoped that the typical Pinterest fan would find a page like this not only fun to build, but gratifying, because they'd be helping to raise money for a cause they cared about. Our thesis was that we'd be able to put in the work to find the early adopters, neophiliacs eager to give shiny new things on the internet a try. We were betting that once they saw that it was working, they'd do it more, moving us deeper along the long tail, generating thousands of pages. And that as the word spread, we'd bring in authors, and they'd be whales promoting their books like crazy. And that people who saw any of our HugDug pages would not only buy at the same rate they'd be buying on Amazon, after all, it was the same price, but would build their own pages, raising their status because they were sharing insights among an elite crowd, all in the service of philanthropy. We kept at it for months, but we failed. I think the main reason we failed was that while we got trial, thousands of pages were built, we failed to find any whales. There were fewer than 6 people who built more than a dozen pages or promoted them very much. The tension dissipated too quickly. People felt like they had no good reason to return after a single visit. The long tail was so long that it wasn't unusual for a HugDug page to sell 0 books in a month. And most people were hesitant to promote a page because even though it's easier now, it's still emotionally difficult to push your friends to visit a shopping site online. The lesson was that a Kickstarter-like success is always more difficult than it looks. We were naive in believing that 4 months was enough time to create an overnight success. We underestimated how difficult it might be to create sufficient incentives. And most of all, we failed to create a tension dynamic that would have turned our early users into connected ambassadors who would have turned the ratchet as we crossed the chasm. We didn't do enough to tell a story about status, and we weren't nearly specific enough about who our first customers would be, what they might have wanted, believed, and said. Case study: Facebook and crossing the biggest chasm. In our lifetime, very few brands have crossed over fully to the mass market. Starbucks, which is familiar to most people listening to this, hasn't made it all the way, and neither has Heineken or even the bagel. but Facebook has. The graph at seths.blog/graphs shows what it looks like. Each bar is users during a given year. The month changed midway, but the idea is the same. Sometime around 2008, a whole bunch of everyone started using Facebook. That leap happened because the reason for signing up changed from "this is sort of interesting" to "this will help me immeasurably" to "I'm the last person on earth who's not using this." Starting at Harvard was part of the secret. The insecure Harvard student had an urgent status need to find out where he or she stood in the pecking order. As it spread through the Ivy League, Facebook crossed one local chasm after another. At each school, a neophiliac went first because they like going first. But the relentless ratchet of status kept it spreading. The more friends you had on Facebook, the higher your status. The other people already on Facebook had a status you admired, other Ivy League students. Facebook was seated in the best possible spot, surrounded by insecure, high-status young people with fast internet connections, plenty of spare time, and an insatiable desire to be seen, to connect, and to move up in some invisible hierarchy. Once it spread through that local tribe, it wasn't hard to jump to other colleges, and then finally the public. This last chasm leap is the billion-dollar one. And once again, status roles kick in. Because Facebook was able to combine nerdiness with status, they were able to surround the middle of the market and create an irresistible ratchet. Join in or face your worst fear. Be socially isolated. As much as most marketers would like to make this last huge leap, it's unlikely. The market is just too big, and the typical network effect isn't that strong. Crossing the local chasm. The good news is that you don't need to set out to cross a global chasm. A local one can change everything. The local elementary school is a fine example. One kid brings in a yo-yo on Monday, but he's the wrong kid on the wrong day. A few weeks later, a charismatic fifth grader brings in her yo-yo, announcing that she's starting the Yo-Yo Union, an exclusive club that's open to all. She's pretty good at tricks, but not so good that she's intimidating, and she brings three more yo-yos with her for her friends. Pretty soon, the four of them are out on the playground, walking dogs and sleeping. She's chosen wisely. Each of these early adopters is a leader in her own right. A week later, there are 30 kids with yo-yos on the playground. The cost of entry is low, the payoff is quick, and the connection feels real. A week later, it seems like the whole school is doing it. Because yo-yos are a fad, without stickiness, they cool off as fast as they spread. Of course, it doesn't have to be that way if you build in identity and persistence. The same crossing happened with Uggs, with black backpacks, with penny skateboards. We only notice the ones that cross a local chasm. But the early adopters are always experimenting around the edges. It's when the combination of adoption and network effects creates enough tension for the idea to cross the local chasm that we notice it. Clean water in a local village. For the lucky and privileged, clean water is a given. We've never known any other form of water. For a billion people around the world, though, the norm is dirty water, infested with parasites. Often requiring a walk of several hours to fetch, this water is essential for life, but it also makes people sick. Consider the case of Water Health International. When WHI arrives in a village with its water purification kiosk, a few residents immediately understand the possibility for impact. They buy a special jerry can from WHI and then pay to have it refilled every day. The few pennies spent on clean water are quickly earned back in time saved, increased productivity, and reduced medical expense. And yet, not everyone buys the water right away. Most people don't. In fact, it follows precisely the same adoption curve as just about everything else, from toys to computers. The early adopters buy it first. They may be educated enough to realize how powerful an input clean water is, but it's more likely that they simply like buying things that are new. Not only are these early adopters eager to go first, but they're eager to talk about their experience. The brightly colored water jugs that WHI requires, so they know that they're not refilling an infected vessel, are a badge of honor and an invitation to converse. But still, the early days are always fairly slow. Changing a multi-generational habit that's as close to survival as water is does not happen right away. Still, the early adopters won't stop talking about it. It's not a fad. Fresh water is needed daily, forever. And water is an easy thing to share and talk about. To further the local shift, WHI sends representatives to the local school. Outfitted with a microscope projector, the rep works with the teacher and has each student bring in some water samples from their home. Projecting the samples on the wall, the microscope tells a vivid story that resonates with the 8-year-olds in the class. This is what germs look like. This is what parasites look like. Inevitably, the students go home and tell their parents. And now, status kicks in. When your young child talks about his neighbors having clean water, and you don't. When you see the respected members of the village hierarchy carrying the distinctive jerry cans. When you hesitate to host someone in your home because you don't have clean water to offer them. This is a ratchet, but not one based on obvious software network effects. It's based on the original network effect, the one built around people in proximity. As more and more people in the village get clean water, those without become socially isolated and feel stupid as well. Most can afford the water because of the time and impact savings, but the emotional shift is the difficult part. Within months, the water has crossed the local chasm from the early adopters to the rest of the village. An aside about B2B marketing. B2B stands for business to business. When a business sells something to another one, it's a third or more of many markets, and the marketing of B2B is no different. It seems complicated, something completely separate. Huge numbers, RFPs, a focus on meeting spec, a price war, long sales cycles, and no fun at all. But it's simpler than that. Consider the growth of LEED certification in the United States. The Green Building Council has a set of efficiency standards that buildings, one of the most expensive items in the world, must meet. When they first launched, only 2 buildings a day were submitted for certification. These were the early adopters, architects and builders who wanted something new to talk about. At that rate, it would have taken 100 years to hit the numbers they hit after just 12. I've posted their growth at seths.blog/charts. What happened? Just before the housing crisis hit, the number of certifications leapt forward, and it kept going. Why? Think about it from the worldview of the real estate developer. He or she is about to spend a highly leveraged sum of money to build a building for rent or eventual resale. If just a few people insist on LEED certification in a building they rent or buy, it's enough to confer status on people who have one of those buildings. And if you skimped when creating the building, you'd have to deal with the regret and fear you'd face if you ended up with a building seen by some as defective. And so, there's a race to the top. each developer has a narrative, and that narrative leads to the selfish but ultimately positive decision to get certified. The one question that every business buyer asks herself is, what will I tell my boss? You are marketing the answer to that question. If you choose this, you can tell your board, investors, boss, that you, the marketer who is out of ideas or energy, finishes that sentence with, bought the cheapest one. For the rest of us, there's the opportunity to finish that sentence with a narrative about status, fear, affiliation, belonging, dominion, safety, commitment, insight, or any of the other emotions we've discussed. Chapter 20, Organizing and Leading a Tribe. It's not your tribe. That's the first thing I say to people who talk about the folks they're lucky enough to work with and lead. The tribe doesn't belong to you, so you don't get to tell the members what to do or use them for your own aims. If you're fortunate, there's a tribe that will listen to you and consider what you say. If you're lucky, they'll interpret your words in a way that they believe will help them move the mission of the tribe forward, and you'll get a chance to do it again. And if you invest in them, they'll show you what they want and what they need. You can gain empathy for them, understand their narrative, and serve them again. The tribe would probably survive if you went away. The goal is for them to miss you if you did. The power of now, not later. Marshall Ganz is the brilliant Harvard professor who has worked both with Cesar Chavez and Barack Obama. He has articulated a simple three-step narrative for action: the story of self, the story of us, and the story of now. The story of self gives you standing, a platform from which to speak. When you talk about your transition from who you used to be to who you became, you are being generous with us. It's not about catastrophizing your situation or the faux empathy of online vulnerability. Instead, the story of self is your chance to explain that you are people like us, that you did things like this, that your actions led to a change, one we can hear and see and understand. The story of us is the kernel of a tribe. Why are we alike? Why should we care? Can I find empathy to imagine that I might be in your shoes? The story of us is about together, not apart. It explains why your story of self is relevant to us and how we will benefit when we're part of people like us. And the story of now is the critical pivot. The story of now enlists the tribe on your journey. It's the peer opportunity, peer pressure of the tribe that will provide the tension for all of us to move forward together. I was like you. I was in the desert. Then I learned something, and now I'm here. Of course, I am not alone. I did not do this alone, and I see in you the very pain I saw in myself. Together, we can make this better. But if we hesitate, or if we leave the others behind, it won't work. The urgency of now requires that we do it together, without delay, without remorse, without giving in to our fear. Story of self, story of us, story of now. Here's a simple example. I used to be 50 pounds overweight. My health was in tatters, and my relationships were worse. Then I discovered competitive figure skating. It was tough at first, but thanks to my new friends on the rink, I got to the point where it was fun. Within months, I had lost dozens of pounds, but more important, I felt good about myself. The real win for me, though, was the friendships I made. I discovered that not only did I feel terrific physically, but being out on the ice with people old friends like you and the new ones I made at the rink made me feel more alive. I'm so glad you were willing to come to the rink today. I called ahead, and they've reserved some rental skates for you. In the first paragraph, we hear the story of our friend, a narrative of going from here to there. In the second, we hear about how it changes our friend's relationships, including to people like us. And in the third, there's a call to action, a reason to do something right now. Manipulation is the tribe killer. In Rules for Radicals, noted labor organizer Saul Alinsky laid out 13 principles that can be used in zero-sum game political settings to discourage and defeat enemies. I'll quote them here. Power is not only what you have, but what the enemy thinks you have. Never go outside the expertise of your people. Whenever possible, go outside the expertise of the enemy. Make the enemy live up to its own book of rules. Ridicule is man's most potent weapon. A good tactic is one your people enjoy. A tactic that drags on too long becomes a drag. Keep the pressure on. The threat is usually more terrifying than the thing itself. The major premise for tactics is the development of operations that will maintain a constant pressure upon the opposition. If you push a negative hard and deep enough, it will break through into its counterside. The price of a successful attack is a constructive alternative. And pick a target, freeze it, personalize it, and polarize it. Alas, this approach is now often used by both sides on just about any issue, and it tears away at civil discourse. When you're so sure you're right that you're willing to burn things down, it turns out that everyone is standing in a burning building sooner or later. What happens if we reverse the rules? Put people to work. It's even more effective than money. Challenge your people to explore, to learn, and to get comfortable with uncertainty. Find ways to help others on the path find firm footing. Help others write rules that allow them to achieve their goals. Treat others the way you'd want to be treated. Don't criticize for fun. Do it when it helps educate, even if it's not entertaining. Stick with your tactics long after everyone else is bored with them. Only stop when they stop working. It's okay to let the pressure cease now and then. People will pay attention to you and the change you seek when they are unable to consistently ignore it. Don't make threats. Do or don't do. Build a team with the capacity and the patience to do the work that needs doing. If you bring your positive ideas to the fore again and again, you'll raise the bar for everyone else. Solve your own problems before you spend a lot of time finding problems for others. And celebrate your people. Free them to do even more. Make it about the cohort and invite everyone along. Disagree with institutions, not with people. All 13 of these principles get to the mission of the marketer, to engage with people and help them create the change they seek, to understand their worldviews and talk and act in ways that align with who they are and what they want, to connect people to one another in an infinite game of possibility. Shared interests, shared goals, shared language. A tribe doesn't have to have a leader, but it often is populated with people who share interests, goals, and language. Your opportunity as a marketer is the chance to connect the members of the tribe. They're lonely and disconnected. They fear being unseen, and you, as the agent of change, can make connection happen. You can intentionally create cultural artifacts, to use status roles, to elevate a costume, a series of code words, or even the secret handshake. You can be Betsy Ross and sew the flag. Betsy Ross herself, the very concept of Betsy Ross, is a symbol. Don't say it all, and don't make it obvious. It's fine that there are secret handshakes, Easter eggs, and unknown features. It's fine that commitment and longevity earn an extra edge. You can challenge the tribe to go further, encourage them to adopt goals, and push them forward. When Nike committed millions of dollars to breaking two, a moonshot to break the two-hour mark on the marathon, they were engaging and challenging the tribe. Even if they don't succeed, they and the tribe members who organize around them will come out ahead. Most of all, the tribe is waiting for you to commit. They know that most marketers are fly-by-night operators, knocking on doors and moving on. But some hunker down and commit. And in return, the tribe commits to them. Because once you're part of a tribe, your success is their success. It will fade if you let it. There's the hope that you can spin up a movement and then get out of the way as it takes on a life of its own. A vision that once you cross the local chasm, you'll become a permanent part of the culture and can move on to the next challenge. In fact, that rarely happens. There are always new ideas beckoning the early adopters. They're on the prowl, and they'll be the first to leave. But those who admire the status quo might leave as well, once the tension is gone. They might have embraced your restaurant, your software, or your spiritual movement for a while, but the original status quo, the one they walked away from, persists as well. And without persistent and consistent inputs and new tension, they'll show up a bit less for you. There's a half-life at work. For any tribal behavior that's not energetically maintained, half of the activity will disappear. Every day, every month, every year, it's not clear what the half-life for a given movement is, but you can expect that it will fade. The alternative is to reinvest, to have the guts to sit with those you have instead of always being distracted to chase the next thing. The best marketers are farmers, not hunters. Plant, tend, plow, fertilize, weed, repeat. Let someone else race around after shiny objects. Take a room in town. Zig Ziglar was a door-to-door salesman of pots and pans. In the 1960s, this was a thing. Most of the 3,000 representatives in his company followed the same plan. They filled their cars with samples and hit the road. They'd visit a town, make all the easy sales, then get in the car and drive to the next town. Early adopters, as we've seen, are easier to find and easier to sell to. Zig had a different strategy. He got in his car, found a new town, and moved in. He took a room for weeks at a time. He showed up and kept showing up. Sure, he made the same early adopter sales as everyone else. But then, people noticed he didn't leave like all the other salespeople they'd seen before. He stayed. By continuing to organize demonstration dinners, he got to know the people in town. He might engage with someone in the middle of the curve 5 or 6 or 7 times over the course of a month, which is precisely what this sort of person wants before they make a decision. Zig did the math. He understood that while most salespeople would flee when they hit the chasm, he could build a human bridge. There'd be days with no sales at all, but that's okay. Because after crossing the local chasm, the volume would more than make up for the time invested. The easy sales aren't always the important ones. Chapter 21. Some case studies using the method. How do I get an agent? That's the question that screenwriters, directors, and actors get asked all the time. The industry has gatekeepers, and you don't have the keys to the gate, so an agent is the answer. As Brian Koppelman has generously pointed out, it doesn't work in this direct a manner. Sure, the agent will field calls for you, but he's not going to become your full-time sales rep, making calls night and day, and tirelessly promoting you to the industry. The method isn't to go out and find an agent. The method is to do work so impossibly magical that agents and producers come looking for you. You, the one who cared enough to put it all on the table, who fell in love with your viewers and your craft, and who made something that mattered. Doesn't have to be a feature film or a Pulitzer-winning play. In fact, the approach works best if it's not a fully polished and complete creation. The best work will create an imbalance in the viewer, one that can only be remedied by spreading the word, by experiencing this with someone else. The tension this imbalance creates forces the word to spread. It means that asking, "Have you seen?" raises the status of the asker, and the champions multiply. What matters is the connection you made. Everyone has 10 friends, 50 colleagues, 100 acquaintances, and you can cajole them into seeing your work. And then what happens? If it's electric, if it makes an impact, if the right sort of tension is created, they'll have to tell someone else. Because telling someone else is what humans do. It's particularly what we do if we work with ideas. Telling others about how we've changed is the only way to relieve our tension. This is the hard work we discovered several hours ago. The hard work of deciding that this is your calling, of showing up for those you seek to change. Do that first. Tesla broke the other cars first. When the Tesla Model S was launched, its primary function was to tell a story that, for a lot of luxury car neophiliacs, would break their current car. Break it in the sense that it wasn't fun to own anymore, wasn't worth bragging about, didn't increase their status as a smart, wealthy person who was clearly smarter and wealthier than everyone else. This luxury car owner went to sleep the night before, delighted that the car in the garage was shiny, new, and state-of-the-art, that it was safe, efficient, and worthy. And then he or she woke up to discover that the story was no longer true. Tesla understood that no one who bought one of the first 50,000 Teslas actually needed a car. They all had perfectly fine cars. So Elon Musk created a car that changed the story that a specific group told themselves, a story that undid their status as early adopters and as tech geeks and as environmentalists and as those that supported audacity. All at once. The existing car companies have always had a hard time turning concept cars into real ones. They launch concept cars at auto shows to normalize them, to socialize their innovations, to make it more likely that the real car, years down the road, won't bomb. They couldn't launch the Tesla, not because they didn't know how, they did, and not because they didn't have the resources, they did. No, Ford and GM and Toyota didn't launch the Tesla because car companies like us don't take risks like this, and their customers felt the same way. Making a car that could have the impact the Tesla did on the story of luxury cars wasn't easy. Musk chose to go to difficult extremes in positioning the car on behalf of his fans. It's the fastest, the safest, and the most efficient car of its size ever, all three. This audacity is available to more and more organizations as technology shifts from, could it be done, to, do we have the guts? The NRA as a role model. There are few groups more controversial than the National Rifle Association. But as focused nonprofit political marketers, they have no peer. They only have 5 million members, less than 2% of the population, but have used that base to change the attitude and focus of thousands of lawmakers. They are generally vilified by the masses, but continue to confound expectations in their impact, revenue, and profile. When nonprofits talk about changing hearts and minds, when they target everyone and seek to get bigger, they can learn critical strategic lessons from the NRA instead. By focusing on the minimum viable audience, just 5 million people, the NRA is very comfortable saying, it's not for you. By activating those members and making it easy for them to talk to their friends, they're able to create significant leverage. A Pew study shows that gun owners are more than twice as likely to contact government officials about their issues than non-owners are. The NRA intentionally creates people like us. They're comfortable with insiders and outsiders and often issue public statements that are, at their best, viciously divisive. They have bent a corner of the culture in significant ways, and they've done it not by changing worldviews, but by embracing them. The NRA isn't my version of better, but it clearly resonates with those that they seek to serve. This persistent, disciplined approach to an issue is precisely how much of the change has been made in our culture. Getting the boss to say yes. It's one thing to market to the world, but it feels quite different to market to one person, like your boss. Except it's not really. Your boss is probably not eager to change her worldview. She wants what she's always wanted. She sees things through the lens of her experience, not yours. She is aware of who the people like us are and what they think. She wants to do things that help her achieve her goals, which probably include status, safety, and respect. If you go to her with what you want, with a focus on price or features or false urgency, it's unlikely to lead to the answer you seek. If you go to her asking for authority without offering responsibility, that too is unlikely to get you very far. But if you can dig deep and see the status roles, can decode dominion versus affiliation, and can use trust to earn enrollment, the process can change. You can produce better by serving the people you market to, turning them from customers to students, gaining enrollment, teaching, connecting, step by step, drip by drip. Chapter 22. Marketing works, and now it's your turn. The tyranny of perfect. Perfect closes the door. It asserts that we're done, that this is the best we can do. Worse, perfect forbids us to try. To seek perfection and not reach it is a failure. The possibility of better. Better opens the door. Better challenges us to see what's there and begs us to imagine how we could improve on that. Better invites us in and gives us a chance to seek dramatic improvement on behalf of those we seek to serve. The magic of good enough. Good enough isn't an excuse or a shortcut. Good enough leads to engagement. Engagement leads to trust. Trust gives us a chance to see if we choose to look. And seeing allows us to learn. Learning allows us to make a promise. And a promise might earn enrollment. And enrollment is precisely what we need to achieve better. Ship your work. It's good enough. Then make it better. Help. When we offer it, we're being generous. When we ask for it, we're trusting someone else to see us and care about us. On the other hand, when someone refuses to offer help or ask for it, everyone is closed, on defense, afraid of the other. If there's no connection, we can't make things better. Chapter 23. Marketing to the Most Important Person. What do we do about the noise in our heads? Where do we find the strength to bring our better to the world? Why is it so hard to develop a point of view? Why do we hesitate when we say to the world, "Here, I made this"? And what's the alternative to hesitating? These don't sound like marketing questions, but in fact, if you let them sit unanswered, they're getting in the way of your marketing. People who aren't as gifted or generous as you are running circles around you because they are showing up as professionals. And yet, too many people with something to offer are holding themselves back. There's a difference between being good at what you do, being good at making a thing, and being good at marketing. We need your craft, without a doubt, but we need your change even more. It's a leap to choose to make change. It feels risky, fraught with responsibility, and it might not work. If you bring your best self to the world, your best work, and the world doesn't receive it, it's entirely possible that your marketing sucked. It's entirely possible that you have empathy for what people were feeling. It's entirely possible that you chose the wrong axes and that you failed to go to the edges. It's entirely possible you were telling the wrong story to the wrong person in the wrong way on the right day, or even on the wrong day. Fine. But that's not about you. That's about your work as a marketer. And you can get better at that craft. This thing we do, whether it's surgery or gardening or marketing, it's not us. It's the work we do. We're humans. Our work isn't us. As humans, we can choose to do the work, and we can choose to improve our work. If we're going to take it personally every time someone doesn't click on a link, every time someone doesn't renew, we can't possibly do our work as professionals. And thus, we get stuck in search of perfect, stuck without empathy, stuck in a corner, bleeding and in pain, because we've been personally maligned. One way to avoid that is to realize that marketing is a process and a craft. Just because the pot you made on the wheel broke in the kiln doesn't mean you're not a good person. It simply means your pot broke and that maybe some lessons in pottery will help you go forward. You're capable of doing better. Realize that as a marketer, the better you are trying to teach or sell to the right person is worth far more than what you are charging. If you are seeking to raise money for a charity, someone who donates $100 or $1,000 or $1 million is only going to do it if they get more value than it costs them to donate. If you're selling a widget for $1,000, the only people who buy it will buy it because they believe it's worth more than $1,000. We bring value to the world when we market. That's why people engage with us. If you don't market the change you'd like to contribute, then you're stealing. Here you are offering more value than you're charging. It's a bargain, a gift. If you hesitate to market your offering properly, it's not that you're being shy. It's not that you're being circumspect. It's that you're stealing because there's someone who needs to learn from you, engage with you, or buy from you. Someone will benefit from your better if you get out of your way and market it. There's a student who's ready to sign up. There's somebody who wants a guide, who wants to go somewhere. If you hesitate to extend yourself with empathy, to hear them, you're letting us down. The marketer's contribution is willingness to see and be seen. To do that, we need to be able to market to ourselves, to sell ourselves every day, to sell ourselves on the difference we're able to make if we persist with generosity and care. You're already telling yourself a story every day. We may market to ourselves that we are struggling. We may tell ourselves that we are unknown and deserve to be unknown. We may tell ourselves that we're a fake, a fraud, a manipulator. We may tell ourselves that we are unjustly ignored. They're as true as we want them to be. And if you tell yourself a story enough times, you will make it true. Make things better. It's entirely possible that the thing you are marketing satisfies no real demand. There is no good strategy behind it, and that you are being selfish in thinking that just because you built it, you should stick with it. Blow it up. Start over. Make something you're proud of. Market something you're proud of. But once you've done that, once you've looked someone in the eye and they have asked, "Will you do that again for me?" Once you have brought value to a student because you taught them and helped them get to the next step, do it again, and then do it again, because we need your contribution. And if you're having trouble making your contribution, realize your challenge is a story you are marketing to yourself. It is the marketing we do for ourselves, to ourselves, by ourselves, the story we tell ourselves that can change everything. It's what's going to enable you to create value, to be missed if you were gone. I can't wait to see what you build next. Is marketing evil? If you spend time and money with skill, you can tell a story that spreads, that influences people, that changes actions. Marketing can cause people to buy something that they wouldn't have bought without marketing, vote for someone they might not have considered, and support an organization that would have been invisible otherwise. If marketing doesn't work, then a lot of us are wasting a great deal of effort and cash. But it does. So, does that make marketing evil? In a story about my blog published in Time magazine, the author wrote, tongue-in-cheek, "Entry you'll never see. Is marketing evil?" Based on a long career in the business, I'd have to answer yes. Actually, I need to amend what this pundit said. I'll add this entry. Are marketers evil? Based on a long career in the business, I'd have to answer some of them. I think it's evil to persuade kids to start smoking, to cynically manipulate the electoral or political process, to lie to people in ways that cause disastrous side effects. I think it's evil to sell an ineffective potion when an effective medicine is available. I think it's evil to come up with new ways to make smoking acceptable so you can make a few more bucks. Marketing is beautiful when it persuades people to get a polio vaccine or to wash their hands before performing surgery. Marketing is powerful when it sells a product to someone who discovers more joy or more productivity because he bought it. Marketing is magic when it elects someone who changes the community for the better. Ever since Josiah Wedgwood invented marketing a few centuries ago, it has been used to increase productivity and wealth. I've got a lot of nerve telling you that what you do might be immoral. It's immoral to rob someone's house and burn it to the ground. But is it immoral to market them into foreclosure? Well, if marketing works, if it's worth the time and money we spend on it, then I don't think it matters a bit if you're just doing your job. It's still wrong. Just like every powerful tool, the impact comes from the craftsman, not the tool. marketing has more reach with more speed than it has ever had.